From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The search is over. On Saturday, the NAACP chose a new president and CEO. His name is Benjamin Todd Jealous, and he's only 35 years old, a civil rights leader who is not part of the civil rights generation. In fact, he'll be the youngest leader ever of the 99-year-old civil rights organization. Jealous was formerly the director of the U.S. Human Rights Program at Amnesty International. He also ran the National Newspaper Publishers Association. And for more, we have regular News and Notes contributor Mary Frances Berry. She's a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and a member of the NAACP's search committee. Hey, Mary.
Hello, Farai.
So the NAACP board took an eight-hour closed-door session to make its choice. So what do you think were some of the pros and cons that were debated in choosing Ben Jealous?
Well, Ben Jealous is, of course, young, and he has good experience for a man that age, but you can't help being young. And to some people, and I think that's right, sometimes it's very risky when you get someone who has less experience than some other people who may be candidates. So that's something you debate. The other thing is to debate whether he meets the needs of the organization at this particular time. The NAACP needs money. It needs members. It needs vision. It needs to work with other organizations, especially some of the younger people who are running organizations and who do things like blogging and using the internet and all kinds of things that are new in terms of technology. So they had to debate whether to go with somebody who fit the old mold or partly fit it, or to take a risk on a guy who's young, exciting, energetic, has good experience, well-educated vision, and is committed to civil rights.
Well, you know, you just ticked off a lot of things. Money, vision, internet strategy. You know, that's a lot to tackle. Let's tackle vision first. You know,
okay.
The NAACP's last president, Bruce Gordon, only lasted 19 months in office. And when we spoke with the current chair of the board of the NAACP, he said, Julian Bond said, that he wanted to keep the organization civil rights focused. Bruce Gordon really wanted to focus on black economics. So what do you think about that divide? What is the vision that you want to see the NAACP develop, or what do you think that Ben Jealous wants to do?
Well, Ben Jealous, insofar as I was able to tell on the search committee, understands that economic opportunity is connected to all other aspects of civil rights in general, that they're not really two separate. There's a nexus between race and class, and that these things both need to be worked on. And he understands that, so he wouldn't be in the business of trying to separate the two or argue about whether one was more important than the other. He also understands that the NAACP is concerned about trying to help the people who have been more left behind in the African-American community. That is, if you have to make a choice in terms of program, try to help those who've already made it, even though they may suffer discrimination, and you can work on that. You'd like to give a hand to those who still are the poor, those who are in communities that are devastated both by violence, by lack of jobs, drugs, and all the things that we know. And I think he understands all that.
Now, money, that's a big one. It's been tight for the NAACP. Do you think that he has the fundraising chops that the organization needs?
Well, he persuaded us on the search committee that he has both the connections, the commitment, the knowledge of people who want to be donors to the kind of vision that he has and that the NAACP has going forward, and that he understands the financial challenge. So one of the big specifications that we were looking for is somebody who was interested in fundraising, had a track record, understood it, and knew how to do it. And he has been running a small foundation, and he has connections with people who are in the fundraising circle. So we think he can meet that need, too. And it's also connected to membership. Increasing membership, which is connected to vision, that's why I ticked off all those things at the same time, is also connected to whether you can raise money or not.
The membership, from what I understand, has a pretty high average age. Do you think he'll bring in younger people?
Absolutely. I think that he will appeal to, there are younger people in the NAACP, though not as many. And I think he will help to revitalize the youth chapters. I think he will work with other young people in other organizations. I think that he will be a standout in that regard.
What about internet strategy? What do you see ahead for the NAACP? I mean, what would you like to see?
What I would like to see is to see the NAACP maximize the use of the new technologies and work with other organizations that are already there. We saw a lot of it around the Jenna discussion and so on, and the radio hosts, the internet people over the internet, and the other organizations that are around the country now, many of them in California, people that Ben Jealous already knows, to start consciously working with them. Because one of the big problems that the NAACP has is that on the ground, lobbying in Washington, trying to get something done on the ground, it's the established people in the established organization, the old NAACP organization and others in the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights that Wade Henderson runs, who do the lobbying. But they often are not as connected as they should be to the people who are out there at the grassroots who operate through the internet. I think that Ben Jealous will make those connections and make it all work.
What about the issue of class? You mentioned it, but the black community is so different than it was a couple of generations ago when you really did, in, you know, because of the color line, have wealthy black people living at least fairly close to poor black folks. And now we've really split up. You have neighborhoods of concentrated poverty, and then, you know, you have some mixing, but not very much. How can the NAACP get people of means involved in issues that affect people who are primarily poor?
Good question. As a matter of fact, black people do give, have a record of charitable giving to the poor that's better than in some other communities. But what really needs to happen is to have more connection in terms of relating to and being with and being around and helping and feeling committed to, on a personal basis, what some people call putting a body on the young people who need somebody there with them and involved in what they're doing in these communities. And so I hope that what Ben will do, since he knows how to do that and he does it himself, that he will be able to help the branches figure out a way that they can, in fact, take under their wing people in some of the communities that are left behind and to work with them.
Of course, we don't live in an all-black world, and in a lot of places, you find black people, like South L.A., you know, in neighborhoods and sometimes in conflict with their neighbors of other races. In South L.A., it's black-Latino. Do you think that the NAACP will or should reach out to particularly other people of color to try to form coalitions?
Well, that's been something that Julian Bond has been emphasizing throughout his chairmanship. I'm not sure the various presidents, the CEOs understood it, but it's the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And Du Bois said at the beginning of the century that it was not just black people, but black, brown, yellow, all the colored races that had to work together. So I think that Angelus comes from a community and a background where he's very much aware of that. I think the NAACP needs to do it, whatever the tensions are, whatever the issues are, whether it's housing or whose turf is available to whom, or immigration or whatever it is, or jobs. I think the NAACP has to do that, and I think Ben will do that.
Now, when it comes to civil rights, I talked to a young activist who is very much within the black community. His entire focus is on young black men, and yet he hates the term civil rights. He thinks civil rights, the term, has undermined civil rights, the movement, because it's outdated in his opinion. What do you think on that score?
Well, some people say that we should say opportunity instead of civil rights, that we should say, somebody told me the other day, maybe we just should say banana every time instead of saying civil rights, that it has certain connotations that are outdated. It's not outdated because the laws under which we operate, anti-discrimination law, is called civil rights law, and that's what the laws are called. So I guess until we relabeled all of them and called them something else, and they apply not just to black people, but to other people who are discriminated against. So I think saying civil rights is not the problem. It's not the label that is the problem. The problem is, what does civil rights mean? How do you encompass opportunity for all? And how do you lift people up who are behind? But if folks want to call it in the vernacular something else, they can do that, but that's not what the laws are called.
Now, I mentioned the NAACP board chair, Julian Bond. He and Bruce Gordon, the former president, had their moments, didn't really see eye to eye. Do you think that the board is in sync with Jealous and that there will be a collaboration that lasts?
Well, I think that having an eight-hour meeting and then coming out of it supporting him, which means that all the issues were debated, and we spent hours in the search committee, countless hours, I can't even remember how many, there were so many, talking to people and listening to people and interviewing and mulling over this. So I think there probably is enough consensus. The board is very tough to work with because it's a big board. And there are a lot of people who have been there a long time and who have track records of their own. But I think that having reached this conclusion, that they will support Jealous. And I think that he now understands, if he didn't before, what the dynamics are in the board. And I think he has the kind of sensitivity and the kind of awareness and commitment and the vibrancy, eagerness of youth, and some maturity, and he respects people who are more mature and older than he is and counsels with them. So I think it'll work out.
On that note, Mary, great to talk to you.
Thank you, Farai.
Mary Frances Berry is a regular News and Notes contributor. She was on the search committee for the NAACP president. She's also a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Some studies say that marriage is a great way for black families to secure economic stability, but if you don't have much money and your spouse doesn't either, could marriage really lift you out of poverty? Today we take a look at marriage and money in black families with our regular economics contributor Keith Reed. He's a reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer and also writes a finance blog for BET called Dollar Out of 15 Cents. And Nisa Islam Muhammad, founder of the Wedded Bliss Foundation, she's also a correspondent for the Final Call newspaper. Hi, folks.
How are you doing?
Hey, Farai.
I'm doing great. So, Keith, let me start with you. Let's break down some numbers. A recent Ohio State University study says married folks have a 77% increase in wealth compared to their single counterparts. The increase for blacks is only around 50%. So why do you think there's a difference in the numbers?
Well, I think the difference in the numbers follows along what we already know about race and wealth in this country, which is that single people, for married families, across the board in African-American communities, the wealth numbers tend to be far less than what you have for whites and across the board in the United States. So I think that's easily explained by a normal disparity there.
Do you think that marriage will make black families, black households stable, even if folks don't have a lot of money?
Not in and of itself. I think it's pretty simplistic to argue that if you just get married, everything will turn around for you, when we know that there are some things that make a person, quote-unquote, marriageable to begin with. In other words, and I said on my blog last week when I talked about this topic that, you know, there isn't a line around the block of black women waiting to marry black males who don't have jobs or who don't have decent bank accounts or decent economic prospects for the future. So I think that you need to bring marriage makes sense when people are bringing something to the table that could help them economically already. And I think it makes not necessarily less sense, but I think it makes it a little bit more difficult to argue that marriage in and of itself will lift you out of poverty if you bring together two people that already are struggling economically.
Nisa, we're going to talk about issues besides money, but on the money tip, what do you think about this question? I mean, does it make economic sense for people to get married? And I'm talking at this point purely economically, even if they don't have a lot of funds.
Marriage offers a lot of benefits that can't be found in other relationships. And the thing to think about in terms of marriage and money is that when people do have the right means, when they are properly, adequately, economically presented with the finances, then, of course, marriage makes sense. If two people are in a bad position, the first thing they need to do is get themselves together as an individual and then begin to think about coming together as a couple to consider marriage.
You've got something called the Wedded Bliss Foundation. So what's the goal of that?
The goal of the Wedded Bliss Foundation is to promote marriage in the black community. As I'm sure you and your audience know, black people have the lowest marriage rate in the country, and our children are the least likely to have the gift of a two-parent family. And so what we do is we talk to the black community about the benefits that marriage has to offer. And also we have something called Black Marriage Day, which is once a year, where we begin to promote and celebrate the benefits that marriage has to offer to the black community.
Tick off a few of these other benefits besides money.
Oh, besides money, married people are healthier. Morehouse did a study where they showed that black married men make more money. They have a greater accumulation of wealth. The children of married couples tend to do better in life. There are a lot of benefits of marriage. You know, the couples have greater access to the families of each other as opposed to couples that are just living together, that are divorced, or single-parent households. It's very difficult to parent and provide at the same time. So when a couple is married, somebody can go to the PTA, somebody can join the community association. You have two parents that are there to devote their time, energy, patience, and to that to the children of that family and help them to grow up to be productive citizens.
Keith, from your personal experience, do you think that marriage provides all these benefits?
From my personal experience, I couldn't tell you because I'm neither married, and I also grew up in a single-parent household. So from my personal experience, it's tough to say. From my observations, I just want to go back to one thing that Nisa mentioned, which is the Morehouse study. The Morehouse study does indeed talk about for black males that incomes tend to go up when you're married. The Morehouse study also does, however, indicate that there's been a history over the last 40 to 50 years of government policies in terms of some programs with welfare, subsidized housing, that also serve to take black males out of households. I mean, if you were in the 1970s or 1980s there was a mother who was receiving welfare and she lived in a housing project, for example, the father couldn't be in that house without the family being penalized for that. You can't argue marriage as an economic benefit to that family if you've got a program that's saying that the man can't be in the house without the family being economically penalized. Those are some of the things that I think we have to deal with if we're going to be advocating marriage as a great equalizer for the black community economically.
Nisa, when you think about the times that we're in, which are very economically challenging, and the fact that some people may need temporary government assistance or may have to rely on relatives, do you think that's going to strain the issue of African-American marriage? I mean, money is one of the main reasons people get divorced, at least in studies.
You know, the government has a lot of disincentives that Keith mentioned to marriage, and they're great considerations for families to look at in terms of college financial aid. A lot of times students are not able to get that if, in fact, they are married. But the thing to look at is that when people are in a situation like that, marriage has benefits to offer independent of what the government has to offer in terms of the government becoming a paper daddy for a family. And there are times now when men want to be responsible for their children. Men want to stand up and say, I am the father of this children. I want to take care of my family. We want to get married. We want to do this together. Once upon a time, black families didn't get government aid and assistance, and they struggled through it, through very hard times. And the thing that we've tried to emphasize is that marriage makes a difference. It is so much more than just a piece of paper.
Now, talking about the government, Keith, a Republican senator from Kansas, Sam Brownback, heads up something called marriage development accounts. Give me a sense of what those are and what they do.
Well, essentially, it's an incentive for a couple. If a couple goes in and they commit to getting married, what will happen is that the government will match a certain amount of their savings. And you've seen programs like this before that are supposed to address many issues. And this is just applying that ability of the government to go in and match some savings that a couple has to the prospect of getting married.
Does anything like that work?
It could. Certainly it could work. I mean, if you were to take anybody and say, hey, we want you to save some money. If I want to buy a house and the government says, hey, every dollar that you save towards buying a house, I'm going to give you another dollar, then great. I think that it definitely can work. I mean, some people would probably argue that it's a little bit It's a little bit unfair, maybe even disingenuous for the government to promote to be getting involved in people's civic affairs, something like marriage, and providing an economic subsidy for it. But I'm not personally against it. I think it can definitely work for somebody, for a family that is trying to bring themselves out of poverty or trying to move forward economically, to get that match from the government.
What about taxes? When you get married, what happens to your taxes if you're at different income levels?
There's an argument to be made at a certain level that getting married is definitely beneficial to you. You can file, you can be a married couple filing jointly, and there's some tax benefit to that. And then after you cross a certain income level, the government can turn around and hurt you. If you've got some things like the alternative minimum tax that can kick in, and for a two-parent, for a two-income household that's bringing in above a certain amount of money, you're filing jointly. Individually, you might not qualify for the alternative minimum tax, but the alternative minimum tax might kick in when you combine those two incomes together. So you could actually take a tax hit at a certain point if you're a married couple filing jointly. Everybody's tax situation, just like for an individual, will differ based on what your circumstances are as a couple, whether or not you itemize, whether or not you file jointly, what your actual tax brackets are. All of those things will come into play for married couples, just like they will for individuals.
And one more thing before I go back to Nisa. There was a Kaiser Family Foundation study recently that found that 7% of Americans that married in the last year did so for health care benefits. I mean, is that kind of practical thinking, or is it, you know, mercenary thinking? How do you make sense of that? Keith?
I'm sorry. I thought that was Vanessa. I mean, on a certain level, it's practical thinking. I mean, if you stand back and say, look, I mean, it is definitely getting more expensive to live. One of the big benefits of being married is that you can have a couple that can go together and say, hey, look, we're going to be able to take care of the health care expenses and make it a little bit less expensive for the household to do that, or get both people covered, which may not happen if you're not married. It can be a little bit dubious if that's the only reason why you're getting married. I mean, you and I may not have such a great relationship, but hey, why don't we go ahead and get hitched anyway, since one of us doesn't have health care benefits? I don't think that really makes much sense. But in the context of a relationship that's working, where two people are working together on other aspects of the relationship, I don't see why it would be a bad idea at all.
Nisa, do you think that couples need to be careful of figuring out the reasons they're getting married and not doing it just for money?
Oh, definitely. One of the things that we offer to couples are marriage education classes, because today so many people want to get together, but they don't know how to stay together. And so we offer marriage education classes, which go along with the marriage development accounts, to help couples be successful. Because it's one thing to be able to save money, but if your relationship is not stable, then the money that you have saved, you're not going to benefit from. So we have classes. We use a curriculum called Basic Training for Couples, and we work with couples over an 8-week period of time to give them the skills to understand why marriage matters. What's the importance of marriage? What does it do for the man? What does it do for the woman? What does it do for children? What does it do to a community when you have strong marriages? We also talk about communication. How do you improve the communication that goes along in a relationship? And the conflict which is sure to come, how can this conflict be managed? And then also, how do you help a couple head toward marital stability so that the commitment is there, they love each other, they want to stay together, so that the money that they've now acquired in this marriage development account, which is really a compensation for a lot of the government disincentives that take place, where the government matches $3 for every $1 that the couple saves, and that money can be used to either buy a home, start a business, or go to school. So we help couples be able to stabilize their relationship, become a happy, loving, healthy couple, healthy marriage, so that what they're able to do with that money in the marriage development account is to be a successful family.
Well, Nisa, Keith, thanks.
Thank you.
Keith Reed is an economics reporter for the Cincinnati Inquirer. He also writes a blog for BET called Dollar Out of 15 Cents, and he joined us from WGUC in Cincinnati. Nisa Islam Muhammad is the founder of the Wedded Bliss Foundation. She also writes for the Final Call newspaper, and she joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. The NAACP's got a new president. Gay marriages are now legal in California, and the father of a slain high school football star wants to change the way the LAPD deals with undocumented immigrants. We'll debate these topics and more on today's Bloggers Roundtable. Joining me are Amani Channel, who blogs at myurbanreport.com, Sean Williams, a blogger with DallasSouthBlog.com, and Sean King, who blogs at SeanInTheCity.com. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right. First up, since we have two Seans, I'm going to have to call you Sean Williams and Sean King every time. So anyway, first up, after years of being called old and irrelevant, the NAACP made a startling move over the weekend, selected its youngest president ever, 35-year-old Benjamin Todd Jellis. So earlier we talked to Mary Frances Berry, who was on the search committee. It is your turn to have your say. Sean Williams, Jellis is only 35 years old, and he has worked in civil and human rights, but he's not a marquee name for most of the public. So what do you think of the pick?
Well, you know, he is young, and I don't think it was a startling pick only because the initial reports had him as Julian Bond's favorite. So it kind of was not a big surprise. He is young, and I do want to make sure everybody realizes, though, that just because he's young doesn't mean that he's necessarily going to attract younger people to the organization, just like with Barack Obama. The assumption was he was going to, just because he's black, he's going to have all black people vote for him. Well, it wasn't the case. He had to work for that. And so I think that, you know, with his resume, it looks like Mr. Jellis might have the opportunity, but there's still a lot of work ahead of him.
Amani, what do you think that he has to do to get young people invested in the NAACP?
Well, I think he has to raise the visibility of the organization. What I do like about him is he has a lot of media experience, which you would assume that he's media savvy and would able to be able to address issues that may be relevant for younger individuals like myself. I'm 33, he's 35, so I look at his resume and I'm like, wow, he's done a lot in his short life, and perhaps he can be an inspiration. Perhaps he can attract and establish a platform for the organization that can get people to get involved with the organization and understand its relevancy even in this time that we're living in right now.
Sean King, one of the issues on the table is what the NAACP actually should do. Should it focus on a traditional civil rights agenda, on black economic empowerment? You know, really, what are we talking about? What do you want to see?
Well, you know, I'm really hoping that that Ben Jellis will have a big say in kind of the future of the organization. And I think part of the problem has been in the past that if there are some expectations of the president, and the president doesn't really have the giftings and the skill set to kind of lead in those areas, it can be a problem. You know, he is not the traditional civil rights leader. And so I think if we're expecting that of him, that's going to be a big mistake. But, you know, I'm hoping here over the next 2 or 3 months that they can really kind of put their heads together and identify some issues where he has strengths and can really lead with some courage and boldness.
Amani, he served as the head of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, and that's the Black Newspaper Publishers Association, and he helped create software that allowed dozens of publishers to put their newspapers online. Now, there's these new groups like The Color of Change that helped organize Gina Six, and they really use the internet well. Do you think Jellis has to do the same with the NAACP?
Well, I think that when you're looking at historic organizations, everyone is looking to how the internet can improve interactivity, help improve and increase activism, and really reach the audience, which is, of course, now going to the internet. So you would hope that his experience in doing so would be able to be applied to the NAACP, and perhaps they will be able to establish some sort of, whether it be developing some software or developing a very interactive website, something to really get the message out, to improve the image, and to get really not only younger people but older people as well. Of course, we're not in the civil rights, it's thought of as the civil rights era, but there are definitely civil rights issues that all Americans are faced with these days. So you'd hope that he'd be able to take some of the issues and be able to attract and engage the community and the United States folks who live here.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Back to our Bloggers Roundtable. Joining me are Amani Channel, who blogs at myurbanreport.com, Sean Williams, a blogger with DallasSouthBlog.com, and Sean King, who blogs at SeanInTheCity.com. So let's jump right back into our roundtable. New topic. In March, a 17-year-old high school football star named Jameel Shaw Jr. was gunned down and killed in Los Angeles. Many Angelenos marked and mourned his death, and the man who killed him is allegedly a gang gang member who was in the country illegally from Mexico. Now the student's father, Jamil Shaw Sr., wants LAPD to change a policy called Special Order 40. It prevents the police from approaching people solely to find out their immigration status. Now, Sean Williams, Mr. Shaw has teamed up with an LA City Council member named Dennis Zine, a former LAPD officer, to try to change the law. So what do you think about that law, Special Order 40? Should it be changed?
Well, Special Order 40 probably should be revisited. You know, if you have someone in custody and they have been accused of a crime, especially if they've been arrested, I don't see a problem with asking them about their citizenship. Unfortunately, in a case like this, it wouldn't have been helpful because the person who perpetrated the crime had been stopped in another city. So, you know, even though he had been arrested, it wasn't in L.A. So, you know, this is a broader issue, and I do think that Mr. Shaw's focus is positive. However, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's going to take a federal effort to really see real change.
Now, Sean King, some people think this crusade comes out of tensions in South L.A. between blacks and Latinos. Could this justified crusade on Mr. Shaw's part actually make things tenser?
Yeah, I think it's doing that right now, and that's unfortunate. And, you know, one of my fears is that Mr. Shaw, I mean, his issue is very real and very deep and personal, and people are starting to kind of use the death of his son as a political football. And the tensions, you know, right now in Los Angeles are really at an all-time high. I mean, it hasn't been this bad in a long time. And so I think the discussion tends to not be a healthy discussion anytime we're talking about relations between black communities and Latino communities in Los Angeles. There's just so much tension there. You know, I think something that I'm not hearing so much, though, is issues like this with an undocumented or an illegal immigrant committing this type of crime. I think, unfortunately, it also hurts all immigrants. And I'm not really hearing, you know, that part of the discussion, because for me, I mean, if this crime had not happened, you would not have the current tensions at the level, you know, that they're in right now. And so when undocumented immigrants kind of commit these kind of heinous crimes, I mean, killing a college-bound star athlete in the middle of the street, it ends up really being kind of a stain, and that's wrong, but a stain on the issues dealing with immigration. So it's complicated for sure.
Amani, should the crusade really be around gang violence and not about immigration?
Well, it seems to be two different discussions or two different conversations that need to be had, because let's say this suspect had committed a carjacking or was in some sort of credit card scheme that wasn't necessarily in that gang violence category. I mean, would, of course, you're still going to have victims. Would you have this crusade against this illegal gang member, which is, of course, how it's going to be stigmatized or stereotyped? You know, there are larger societal issues that we have to look at in terms of the gang violence, the gang culture that exists in California and throughout this country, as well as how is this country going to address the issues that are related to illegal immigrants. I mean, we all know that illegal immigrants are making up a large portion of some job categories in this country. So there, you know, there is a need for them in that way. But of course, no one wants to be victimized by someone who's in this country illegally. So there are definitely more discussions that need to be had. I don't know how this Special Order 40, how it's really supposed to be applied. The way I understand it is that it prohibits officers from initiating contact just to find out a person's immigration status. So you could have a situation where police could be racially profiling Hispanics or anyone else for that matter, just on the sole purpose of, well, if this Special Order 40 gets done away with. So definitely a complicated issue. I feel for the families. You know, Mr. Shaw and his family, of course, he has to do something, and he probably he has no choice but to tackle it in this way. But there's just a lot of questions and a lot of issues that this whole subject raises.
Farrah, this is Sean King. You know, my real agitation with this is, you know, a lot of people in Los Angeles are saying, and you brought up just the issue of gang violence. You know, it is true that 90% of the gun crimes and murders in Los Angeles are committed by people of the same race, but you can't tell Jamil Shaw Sr. that. I mean, had this man who's accused of killing his son not been in the country illegally, it's highly likely that his son would be alive right now. And so I think people are trying to divert the attention back to gang violence. Hey, that's a real issue, and that's something that should be getting tons of attention, and it does get a lot of attention. But the fact of the matter is, Jamil Shaw Jr., would not be dead right now if the issue of undocumented immigrants was dealt with better in Los Angeles. And the city, in so many ways, kind of has a hands-off policy with undocumented immigrants. And I mean, I think because it's so complicated, people aren't really jumping in there to say, hey, how can we fix it? And ultimately, it hurts the black community because of this tension, and it even hurts immigrants, particularly in Los Angeles, when these types of crimes happen.
All right, guys, I'm going to have to move to a speed round. I'm going to ask you all the same question about our last topic. The state Supreme Court in California overturned a ban on same-sex marriage. Now, on the other hand, an initiative to amend the state constitution to ban gay marriage will probably qualify for the November ballot. Do you think this is going to become a hot political issue and possibly even get into the presidential race, a debate? Sean Williams.
I think one reason why it won't take hold like it did in 2004 is because, number one, John McCain is not the true conservative that the Bush White House was. So I don't think that he's going to take the stand, as well as the three candidates who are left all have a very similar stance in the fact that they think that the state should make the decision. So because of that, I don't think that it'll be the same as 2004.
Imani?
Yeah, I don't see it as a big issue. Of course, you might have some conservative Christians that would like to see this issue addressed, but they're just far more important issues. I mean, we have a war that's going on that so many people are opposed with. The economy is just in the tank right now. There are just bigger issues, bigger fish to fry right now that hopefully our national leaders will be considering during this election campaign.
Sean King?
I think it is going to become an issue. You know, in 2004, the war was you know, at a terrible point. And this issue still became kind of a hot-button issue that really swayed a lot of voters. And the question for me is, will McCain flip-flop? I don't think Barack Obama is going to flip on the issue. But at one point, McCain was for the tax cuts. He's against the tax cuts. He's for them. You know, at one point, he was for talking with Hamas. Now he's against talking with Hamas. I think the X factor is, will the people that have McCain's ear encourage him to flip-flop on this issue? And if he does, I think they could begin to kind of use it as a wedge issue, not just with white voters, but with black voters as well. I mean, it's a very big issue in black communities around the country. And so if McCain flip-flops, it could be an issue.
All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Farai.
Sean Williams blogs for DallasSouthBlog.com. He joined me from Cake Mix Recording Studios in Dallas, Texas. Imani Channel blogs at MyUrbanReport.com. And Sean King writes for SeanInTheCity.com. Imani and Sean King join me from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. A family that cooks together stays together. At least that holds true for Patrick and Gina Neely. As co-owners of Neely's Barbecue, they've turned their family restaurants into one of the most successful barbecue chains in the South. They also host a TV show on the Food Network called Down Home with the Neelys. Pat and Gina are fun, folksy, and family-oriented. Pat started our chat by telling me how it all got started.
First of all, I was 23 years of age, and you know, I always felt like, even back then, that the best thing I had going for me was my age, and the worst thing I had going for me was my age, because I was young enough to make mistakes, yet at the same time, I was going to be young enough to recover from them. So, you know, it was a very, very gutsy move, because he and I, we didn't have a quarter. And I'm sure you're saying, well, how did you open up a restaurant without any money? Well, my grandmother, who was in her 90s, was gracious enough and had enough faith and confidence in us to use our house as collateral. And we took out a small $20,000 loan, opened up a 2,000 square foot restaurant in 1988. And the first day we opened, we were dead broke. We didn't have a cash register. It was so many things that we didn't have that I wouldn't dare try to open up a restaurant in today's time without. But in less than the 2 years, we leased the building for 2 years. In 2 years, not only had we paid my grandmother her money back, but we had saved $40,000. And we took that money and used it as a down payment and purchased our first restaurant.
Well, you know, I want to go to you, Gina, because I understand that there was a reunion at which you two reconnected. Tell me about that, first of all.
Pat and I dated in high school. As a matter of fact, our parents went to the same high school. And we got back together. We dated all through high school. We broke up, of course, and then we got back together at our 10-year reunion.
Pat, do you ever think, oh, my gosh, I work with my wife, and now I'm under this microscope, you know, as we do the show? Or do you think it brings you closer together? How do you feel about all that?
Well, first of all, you know, Gina and I made a pact when she first started working in the restaurant, and this was a sincere pact, that if in fact it ever affected our marriage, that we would cease working together, because we've always felt like raising our girls, staying married, is the most important thing. I mean, we've often talked about, you know, the divorce rate is 50%, but we always said we were going to be that other 50%. And I must say, with this new venture, Gina and I, we really didn't have a whole lot of expectations as it relates to the Food Network. As a matter of fact, it wasn't something we pursued. It just so happened that they asked us. We said, well, we'll give it a shot. It turned out to be successful, and we're delighted based on that. As it relates to us being married, the best part about this entire show is the fact that I'm able to share it with her and we're able to do it together. For so long, Gina felt like, well, I'm coming into the family business. It's you and your brothers. But let me tell you something. She came in with a bang and she took care of business from day one. And so now that this is something that she and I can sink our teeth in, and she has as much of a partnership or an ownership of this whole show as I do, I'm thrilled. I'm more thrilled for Gina than I could ever be for myself.
A lot of folks see you as also role models for Black marriage, you know, holding up this idea based on what you said of really trying to be that other 50%, the 50% mm-hmm. that stays together. Gina, do you see yourself as a role model?
I'm not sure if I see myself as a role model. That, you know, I don't know if I want to hold up the whole, you know, African-American race as a whole. But I know for me personally, I think it is a great avenue to get our message out there. And it's sort of like a ministry to me, because the show has really been a blessing to my marriage. And what we're trying to show is that you can have a great marriage and have balance within your home and work together. And also, you know, people really see cooking as more of a duty, but I think if we can kind of see the love and the generosity that goes into that, and hopefully understanding that it represents a much bigger picture than the fact that it's a cooking show, but it also shows a very young couple working together, achieving something, and that you can have it all, and that you can work with your husband and have beautiful children and love as a whole.
I love that young couple. I love that comment. You know, we like to be considered a young couple.
But we are a young couple.
I don't know about role model and the word role model, but I like the word responsibility. And Gina mm-hmm. and I do feel a tremendous amount of responsibility in terms of the images we project, and the fact that hopefully, you know, we get letters all the time. And I think one of the nicest letters we received was from one of our fans that watched the show that says, you know, you guys have really enhanced my marriage. Mm-hmm. Me and my husband get in the kitchen, we cook, and we spend time together. And it's those type of testimonies that really motivate Gene and I and make us feel real good about what we're doing.
Right. Now, I want you to make my taste buds jump. I am not in front of any of your food, but I want you to describe this dish that sounds so intriguing. Barbecued spaghetti. What does that taste like?
Girl, when we get through, you're gonna go get your plane ticket.
Yeah.
You know, Gene and I came from very humble beginnings. We didn't have a whole lot, and we both came from large families. We both basically came from single parents. I mean, I lost my father at 11 to a massive heart attack. My mother was 39, and Gina's mother was divorced, and so she was in a family of five. I was in a family of six. And what that means, and particularly in the South on a limited income, is that you're going to eat at home a lot. So we ate home every day, and I came from a family of five boys, and my mother cooked all these big meals. I mean, stew and chili and meatloaf and roast beef, the big hearty meals. But one of the dishes that she cooked on a weekly basis was Italian spaghetti. You know, in our house, we would have to have a meat with spaghetti. I mean, a lot of people, that's the entree, but spaghetti was a side dish for us. So, you know, when me and my brother started in the restaurant business, there are over 100 barbecue restaurants here in the Memphis metropolitan area. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to separate ourselves a little bit by having signature dishes that no one else had or that we could put our own stamp on. So we started with this barbecue spaghetti, and we said, you know, we could pull out the tomato sauce mm-hmm. and add barbecue sauce, pull out the pulled pork, the ground beef, and put pulled pork in it. Mm-hmm. So we would saute bell peppers and onions. We'd play around. And my uncle actually sold it in his restaurant. So when we started, but it was very early on, a few restaurants was doing it, but it didn't really have the substance like it has now. And ironically, when we first put this recipe together and tasted it, we said, man, this is going to be knockout. when people would come to the restaurant, they thought we had lost our minds. They were like, "You, these guys have gone nuts. They're young. They don't know what they're doing. And they're selling barbecue spaghetti. And now it's running out. I mean, 60, 70 to 100 gallons per store per week. I mean,
wow.
we sell a lot of it. And it's a great item because what you have to do here in Memphis with barbecue being so prevalent is have a diverse menu. I mean, we do things like barbecue nachos. We do a Neely spud. You know, we do a barbecue salad. So mm-hmm. what we've tried to do is really diversify our menu, but do like McDonald's. Stay consistent with what you believe in. Don't start frying chicken and cooking collard greens.
Or making a burger.
You know, or even hamburgers. We don't even sell those. Stay with what you do. Do it well. But you can diversify it a little bit, and that's what we did, and it's a very, very popular item now.
Congratulations on all of the moves that you've been making.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All
Please
right.
make your way
All
to
right.
Memphis before long.
I will. Keep the spaghetti warm for me. Pat and Gina Neely are co-owners of Neely's Barbecue. Some of their favorite recipes can be found at our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. You can catch Down Home with the Neelys on the Food Network.